Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Charles Dickens lived 58 years, 1812 to 1870, into the heart of the Victorian era. At 12, he was child labor in a bootblack factory. By his 30s, he was world famous, and finally a 19th century superstar. From works from David Copperfield and Oliver Twist to A Tale of Two Cities and, of course, A Christmas Carol, stories that brimmed with debtor's prison, child labor, prostitution, rats, disease, sudden death, and the triumphant hope of humanity. This hour, On Point, a new look at the life and prodigious work of Charles Dickens. You can join the conversation. Do you still read, rise to Dickens? Was it the school assignment you can't forget? And what's Dickensian now? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Dickens is in the theaters again this season. A new Disney version of A Christmas Carol in 3D stars Jim Carrey as the crotchety Scrooge. Here Scrooge is visited on Christmas Eve by the ghost of Jacob Marley, his former business partner, who is forced to carry heavy chains in the afterlife as punishment for his greedy ways.
He will be haunted by three spirits.
That's the chance of hope. I'd rather not.
Expect the first. Tomorrow when the bell tolls one.
Can't I take them all at once and have it over with, Jacob?
Expect the second the next night at the same hour. And the third upon the next night when the last stroke of 12 has ceased to vibrate.
There it is, the full Disney treatment for A Christmas Carol. Point is, I suppose, it's still around a century and plus after Dickens brought it to us. Joining me from London is Michael Slater, a top Dickens scholar and emeritus professor of Victorian literature at Birkbeck College, University of London. He's past president of the Dickens Society of America and the International Dickens Fellowship, where he edited their journal, The Dickensian. He's written and edited many works on Dickens, including Dickens and Women and An Intelligent Person's Guide to Dickens. His new definitive biography is titled simply Charles Dickens. Michael Slater, welcome to the show. It's wonderful to have you.
Thank you for inviting me.
You've devoted your life to this man and his work. I guess lucky for you, lucky for us all, his staying power is pretty intense, whether it's a Disney film or just the stories themselves. These are by no means going away. They really stick. Why? What makes them so very, very persistent in imagination and in people's hearts and minds?
Well, I guess primarily it's Dickens' characters, that he had this astonishing ability to, as it were, create almost mythological figures like Mr. Micawber, Mr. Pickwick, Mrs. Gamp, Miss Havisham, who just become definitive types of some aspect of human nature. Of course, all the novels were originally illustrated so that there was an image imprinted on the public consciousness by his first illustrators of Mr. Pickwick, sort of round, beaming, fat, inspector, wearing gaiters and so on. I think it is above all not so much the stories, though the plots are enormously complicated and fascinating, but the actual characters, which is of course one of the reasons, I suppose, that Dickens has always been so attractive to film directors, theatre directors, actors, because of the chance to recreate one of these amazing characters.
Some of the reviews of your book have looked at Dickens and called him the greatest novelist ever in the English language. Others look at a kind of a competition between the more cool and analytical Jane Austen and Charles Dickens with his intense theatricality. How do you look at that as a Dickens guy? Is Jane Austen the competition, and what's the alternate worldview there? What's competing between Dickens and Austen?
Gosh. Well, they both create a world, of course, like I suppose many great novelists do. It would be easy to say, I guess, that Jane Austen's world is more restricted, that little square of ivory that she talked about. Mm. I think it's also restricted in class. I think that Jane Austen has a wonderful range of the English language, but nothing like the register that Dickens has. She also creates memorable characters, but they are, I think, people that you might have met or feel that you perhaps have met, people who are very, very like them. Whereas Dickens' characters, I think, are more the kind of characters you would love to meet or dread to meet, slightly larger than life.
Would you be good enough to take us back to the childhood that famously shaped so much of his impression of the world and maybe much of his work as well? How did it happen that his father ended up in debtor's prison and young Dickens at 12 in a bootblack factory pasting labels on cans of polish?
Well, this is, I suppose, the first of the Dickens mysteries that for the first 9 years of his life, he had a very comfortable middle-class childhood in Chatham, where his father was an employee of the Navy Pay Office, well-established clerk in mm-hmm. the government post, you know, with a good pension and all the rest of it. They lived with servants in a very pleasant house, and Dickens went to school, as did his siblings. Then when the family, they moved briefly to London, then came back to Chatham. But when they went to London for good, when John was posted, still working for the Navy Pay Office, posted to London in the time when Dickens was just 10 years old, mm-hmm. at 1822, he seems to have got into, John Dickens, the father, seems to have got into enormous entanglements and debt, owing money all over the place. And nobody quite knows what he spent all that money on, or how he, why he suddenly became so enormously in debt and unable to meet his debtors. One of the things that happened as a result of the family suddenly becoming rather impoverished was that they lived in rather poor part of London, Camden Town, in North London, actually where Bob Cratchit, Scrooge's clerk, lives in The Christmas Carol.
Yep.
It's no accident, I think, mm-hmm. that Dickens places him in a little house in Camden Town. They couldn't afford school fees, so Dickens' schooling was broken off. They did manage to scrape together fees to send his sister, who was 1 year older and musically very talented, to the Royal Academy of Music to learn the piano and singing. And Dickens, of course, was hurt very much. I think that money was found somehow, and rather irregularly, to pay his sister's fees at the Royal Academy of Music. But no money was available to send him to school. And for a while, nothing seemed to be done with him at all. Age sort of 10, 11, he said he just mooched around, you know.
Streets of London.
That's right. I mean, he was sent on such poor errands as arose out of our poor way of living, he said. He blacked his father's boots. That's rather a significant detail, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Ran messages, lounged about the streets of London, insufficiently fed, and said, for any care that was taken of me, I might have become a little robber or a little vagabond. Mm. He the story of Oliver Twist, basically. He greatly resented this.
And then actually into the factory at 30 Strand.
And then,
a year and more.
For just over a year. His mother had a relation who had become manager of a blacking factory and found a position there for little Charles at 6 shillings a week, which was, considerable sum of money for a boy of 11 to be earning. I mean, Bob Cratchit, to bring him in again, I mean, he kept a whole family on 15 shillings a week, though rather frugally. So that puts it a little bit in perspective, that it wasn't starvation wages. But for Dickens, it was deeply, deeply humiliating that he was sent to work with what he called labouring men and boys. His schooling was broken off, and as he put it, all hopes of growing up to be a learned and distinguished man were crushed within my breast.
One of his colleagues a young Bob Fagin, another name that, of course, famously
That's
comes
right.
into Oliver
yes,
Twist.
Yes. Very curious, that is, because Dickens says rather airily, I afterwards borrowed his name for one of my characters.
Yeah,
as though, you know,
pretty rough
Fagin
one.
Was, as though Fagin was any old character. Yeah. And he says no more than that. But it is fascinating because Bob Fagin, who was slightly older than Dickens, was the boy who was very kind to him and protected him, looked after him. Dickens had, the young Dickens had a sort of terrible seizure, a terrible pain in his side that he had this recurrent trouble when he was young. Bob Fagin helped him by putting warm stones against his side, trying to help him.
Hold the thought there, if you would, Michael Slater. Positively Dickensian there at age 12, in his 30s, famous, world famous. Michael Slater has written a new biography of Charles Dickens. You can join us this hour. Does Christmas take you back to Dickens? Tiny Tim, Scrooge, Bah Humbug. Is there no end to Dickens? I'm Tom Ashbrook. Here's music from the new film. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the Dickensian beginnings and astoundingly prolific life of Charles Dickens. Michael Slater is with us. He is the author of a fabulous new biography of Charles Dickens. It's titled simply Charles Dickens. The London Times cites him for his matchless knowledge of all things Dickensian. And he is right at the top of the world's Dickens scholars. Michael Slater joins us from London. And Michael Slater, we have a lot of listeners already eager to chime in. Let's go to Sheila in De Poyster, New York. Hi, Sheila. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. My comment was just that I feel that Dickens really represents justice well and how justice and humanity work together. He seems to have been able to, even more than his characters are fascinating and his plots, but just the idea of justice, there's a certain amount of justice that any class of person deserves, and if you know, you're worthy, whatever end you're on. And my question would be is if the author thinks that anybody Dickinsonian could survive today, because in my feeling, society that we have now is much like the Victorian society of using people, and humanity is kind of in this contrived reality of reality shows. I mean, if Scrooge was an actual person today, he'd be on Oprah or The View or any of those shows, and he would somehow explain away his inhumane aspects, and he'd be a hero and not what Dickens made him, which was just a real person.
Celebrated for his curmudgeonly ways. Wonderful, Sheila. Michael Slater, how about it first on the sense of justice and humanity in Dickens, and then you know, what he might see in society now through his lens as opposed to his own time.
Yeah, well, I think Sheila puts her finger right on a very, very important thing about Dickens, which was very well expressed by the great novelist and man of letters, G.K. Chesterton, in the 1930s. He was actually president of the Dickens Fellowship, and he wrote a wonderful book on Dickens. And in it, he said that Dickens was not against any institution so much as a certain expression on the human face. And that expression was the rejection of brotherhood or sisterhood, the sense that, you know, other people, somebody might not count. He says he loves Christmas, or rather Scrooge's nephew says, doesn't he, that he loves Christmas because it's a time that reminds us that we all belong to one species and that other people aren't poorer people, for example, and so on. They're not a different species bound on a different journey, mm-hmm. and so on. He was, of course, against the delays of the law, the corruptions of government, the workhouses, etc., all these institutions. But above all, he was against that sort of sense of denial of brotherhood. Mm. And I think that that's what Sheila's pointing to, that everybody is important for Dickens. Poor Joe, the crossing sweeper in Bleak House, who's right at the bottom of the social heap, is treated by Dickens with just as much feeling and dignity and so on as the aristocrats at the top of the heap. He's and just yet, as important.
And yet, as he did that in book after book, you write that he did not share with the many who knew him the story of his own childhood factory time, the sort of shame of that in his life.
Well, he shared it posthumously. I mean, he wrote it all down in his 30s in the so-called autobiographical fragment that his friend John Forster published in his biography of Dickens, written in the years immediately following Dickens' death. Mm-hmm. And I'm quite sure that Dickens knew that it would be made public, his description of his hardship
in time.
But he was extremely sensitive and an extremely private man. He was also very concerned, strangely in some ways, very concerned about social status. His father, for example, was the son of servants, upper servants, admittedly, in a very upper class household. But his father had been a butler and his mother a housekeeper. That's John Dickens's parents. Mm-hmm. Okay,
Dickens's
grandparents. Mm-hmm. John Dickens, presumably his education had been paid for by his father's employers, and he set himself up very much as a gentleman. And once he got this job as a government clerk, he and his wife lived very genteelly. And I think that the whole family was extremely sensitive about its social status. Once Dickens, as a young man, started to make his own way as a journalist, first of all, then as a writer, he certainly did not want, and nor did his parents, any revelations about misfortunes in the past. The fact that the family had fallen on hard times, mm-hmm. John Dickens had even been in a debtor's prison. Mm-hmm. So he was, although he told the story of his life, of course, above all in David Copperfield, he told it through fiction. What Dickens loved best of all, I think, was kind of, in a sense, sharing with his readers, but only he knew that he was really sharing with them.
It's remarkable.
If you see what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go to Pamela, if I may, in Ossable Forks, New York. Pamela, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. How are you?
Very well.
I just wanted to make a comment at how traditional having the Dickens for Christmas is for me. We would always go and buy our Christmas tree on Christmas Eve, and this is as a child. Mm-hmm. And on television, they would have the Christmas story every single Christmas Eve as we decorated our tree. And it just was such a wonderful combination.
Putting up the tree and having Christmas Carol, but the old one, not Jim Carrey, obviously.
No. I would love to see the old one. Jim Carrey does a good job.
Oh, I suppose he does 3D and all the rest. There's a little whiz-bang. I've got a little bit here from the 1951 film, Christmas Carol. This was directed by Brian Desmond Hurst. Features Alistair Sim as the classic Scrooge. Here it is at the end of that wonderful story, waking up on Christmas morning to realize it's not too late to turn his life around.
I don't know what to do. I'm as light as a feather. I'm as happy as an angel. I'm as merry as a schoolboy. I'm as giddy as a drunken man. A merry Christmas, Ebenezer. You old humbug. And a happy new year, as if you deserved it.
That's about as giddy as it gets. That's wonderful. He wrote again and again about Christmas, Michael Slater. It was not just A Christmas Carol. In his super prolific life, this was a frequent subject.
Absolutely. I mean, A Christmas Carol, of course, was an enormous, enormous success. Everybody loved it. His great rival, Thackeray, who is also a novelist and in some ways, as I say, a rival to Dickens, said that he thought the Christmas Carol was a national benefit and to every man and woman who read it, a personal kindness. The first edition sold out immediately. It was reprinted and reprinted and was a huge success, not so much a huge commercial success for Dickens, unfortunately, because it cost so much to produce. Dickens insisted on hand-coloured illustrations by the great Punch artist John Leech and on a very beautiful little presentation, crimson cover, gold blocking on the spine and so on. And all that cost a great deal of money, but he still insisted that the book should only sell at 5 shillings because he wanted it to be within the reach of poorer readers. So the result was it didn't make a great deal of money, and he was rather disappointed about that. Nevertheless, the huge popular success of it and all the people writing in to tell him how much they loved it, he went on to write 4 more Christmas books each year after that, up to the last one, The Haunted Man, in 1849. And these were in exactly the same format as the Carol, not hand-coloured illustrations, of course, so that every Christmas people were expecting a little Christmas book from Dickens. One reviewer, getting a bit jaded, I suppose, said that, you know, Mr. Dickens's appearance on the publishing stage was expected at Christmas as regularly as the clowns in the pantomime.
I was just going to say that
he did then continue to write a Christmas number in each of his weekly magazines from 1850 through to 1869.
We should give us a sense of just how great, how high the towers of his fame were. I mean, it came relatively early, but I'm not sure we fully appreciate today just what a towering figure he was in his lifetime. Give us some sense of that.
Well, I could only give that by the sense of the number of people who flocked, for instance, to hear his public readings from 1857 onwards. He was regularly addressing audiences of 3,000 or 4,000 people, reading his books to them. He talked about his relationship with his public, which was personally affectionate and like no other man's. Of course, it was the beginning of the age of photography. As well. So Dickens's image, first of all, his image as engraved from portraits of him in the 1830s and 40s, and then in the later 40s and 50s onwards, photographs of him, his image became very, very well known. And he was recognised in the streets. He particularly delighted to the fact that I think it was in Ireland when he was on one of his reading tours, people would come up to him in the street and want to shake his hand. One of them said, "I want to shake the hand that's filled my house with so many friends." It's the great characters again. He was enormously well known. He was the first, I guess you could say, really the first great celebrity. And this both in England and America.
Didn't exactly enjoy his first trip to America. Felt pawed and sort of pushed around by the adoring crowds everywhere and went home not too happy about it.
Well, I think there's Jane Smiley recently wrote a very good short biography of Dickens, and she described the 1842 visit as the nightmare book tour, which is really what it was. I mean, because Dickens and his wife were just kind of thrown to the mob, as it were. They had no manager, they had no team. Dickens hired a secretary, but he had no protection, really, from the mobs and crowds that followed him everywhere in America. I think it brought out something very very deep in him. I mean, as a child working in the blacking factory, one of the worst things for him had been the people outside in the street looking through the window and seeing him working at his bench, pasting these labels in all his humiliation, as he saw it, and degradation. And now again, again, he was, as it were, being made a show of. It had never quite happened like this before in England, though he had become, you know, enormously celebrated. But this tour of America, he was kind of put on show again, and this brought out almost hysterical reaction in him.
On the stage, in his readings, he was almost hyper-theatrical, the way he would inhabit the characters as he went deep into these stories. Somehow suggested that it was almost deranged, but I don't know how you look at it, Michael Slater. What drove that super theatricality on stage?
Well, I think it was his delight in acting. He talks in several of his letters and so on about the inexpressible delight of losing himself in another identity. He did, in fact, contemplate becoming an actor when he was a young man, and he was very ambitious to get famous some way, and he was working as a young journalist. He was going to go for an audition at Covent Garden, but then he had a bad cold and couldn't go. And just after that, his first story got accepted, and so he got fame as an author rather than as an actor. But as Thackeray, to quote him again, said, he's watching Dickens act in the amateur theatricals that he loved to organise. Dickens said, if that man would go up on the stage now, he would earn his 10,000 a year. He was such a superb actor. Everybody agreed on that.
And he left crowds in tears, absolutely in tears, while watching his readings, listening to Oliver Twist or whatever it was, tears.
Well, particularly towards the end of his career, when he introduced The Murder of Nancy by Bill Sykes into his readings. I mean, people actually fainted in the audience. I think it was at Bristol on one occasion where he said, we had up to six ladies carried out as stiff as a board, having fainted, you know. So overpowering was his enactment of Bill Sykes' Murder of Nancy.
Amazing. Let's get a call from Tina in Nashville, Tennessee. Tina, you're on the air.
Hello, thank you so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to make a very personal comment. I developed a deep appreciation for Dickens' writings when I moved to New York City. I was a young, struggling artist, and I remember sitting on the subway, being jostled among the hundreds of people, commuting to work, and reading David Copperfield, which you mentioned earlier is one of his more autobiographical works, and he painted such a vivid picture of suffering that I kept saying to myself over and over and over, you know what? My life is not that hard. And I appreciated that so much. It was a very personal gift that I feel like his writing gave to me. And if I had a question, it would be, do you feel that that is part of the allure of his writing, that it's so relatable and yet it helps people get perspective on their own lives?
Oh, thank you, Tina. Michael Slater.
Well, it's very interesting that Tina says that, because just the other day I received a letter from somebody who'd been reading my biography, a man in his 70s, and he, very much like what Tina's just said, he'd had a very unhappy childhood, a disrupted family, etc., and he derived enormous consolation and strength from reading David Copperfield. I think it's that novel, perhaps above all, that does have that effect on people. The sense that gets one's own sufferings in proportion, I suppose, the extreme sufferings of poor David, and the way he wins through them.
And the compassion.
It's a wonderful testimony.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Dickensian beginnings and astoundingly prolific life of Charles Dickens. The Dickens scholar Michael Slater joins us from London. His big, new, definitive biography is Charles Dickens. Here's a couple of clips. First from Little Dorrit, tells the life of Amy Dorrit, whose father had been in debtor's prison for decades. Amy, with family friend Arthur Clennon, visits Mr. Dorrit to tell him that he's come into a large inheritance, that he'll soon be free. Here's a scene from the Emmy Award-winning 2008 BBC miniseries with Tom Courtney as Mr. Dorrit and Matthew McFadden as Arthur Clennam.
Mr. Clennam, am I to understand that I could pass through the gate at this very moment?
I think not quite yet.
So I am still confined.
It is but a few hours, sir.
Few hours. You talk easily of hours, sir. How long do you think an hour is to a man who is choking for want of air?
There, from Little Dorrit, wanting out of debtor's prison, and Oliver Twist, of course, showed Victorian London's crime-ridden, gang-banging underbelly. Here's the famous asking, hungry scene with young Oliver, his bowl extended for a bit of gruel. Barney Clark as Oliver Twist.
Please, sir, I want some more.
What?
Please, sir, I want some more.
From Roman Polanski's 2005 film adaptation right there. Michael Slater is with us in London. McLean is calling from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. McLean, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Michael. It's a pleasure to be on the show. I'm glad you guys are talking about this. I actually just started reading Christmas Carol last week. I found it in my dad's bookcase.
Great.
But the comment I wanted to make was a lot of people always talk about how miserable and just kind of depressing Charles Dickens's stories are, which is certainly true, but I remember being forced to read Great Expectations in junior high,
mm-hmm.
and kind of falling in love with the book and actually rereading it, one of the few books I've gone back and reread over the years.
Miss Havisham and all the rest, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and the one thing that always struck me about it was that it was really funny. I always thought it was kind of dry and sarcastic and had this dark humor about it. And it's something I've noticed in some of my other favorite books through the years, like Catcher in the Rye and The Great Gatsby. And it's something that I don't really hear a lot of people talking about how funny it is. And I'm even noticing the same thing in A Christmas Carol, and I wonder if Michael could talk about that a little bit.
Oh, yeah, plenty there. Let us pick it up. Michael Slater, what about humor in Dickens?
Yeah, well, of course, that's what I think of primarily. Dickens is a great humorist, and Great Expectations, although in some ways it is a sad book, I mean, it contains some of the funniest scenes in Dickens. I think the wonderful comic character of Mr. Wopsle, the parish clerk, who's a sort of comic counterpart of Pip, because he comes to London like Pip to make his fortune. Well, Pip comes to London with his fortune made, as he thinks.
Mm.
Mr. Wopsle comes to London to be a great actor and jumps in at the deep end by playing Hamlet in a little kind of flea-pit theatre where Pip goes to see him. And it's a hilarious description of an extraordinarily bad theatrical production. And there are many other scenes, I think, and just amazing phrases in Great Expectations. Miss Havisham's toady relations who come to see her hoping to win favour by pretending to be very, very concerned about her. And one of them, the husband, says to his wife, "My dear, it's well known that your concern for Miss Havisham is making one of your legs shorter than the other." Absolutely absurd thing. And then you have the marvellous comedy of Mr. Wemmick, Jaggers's clerk, who has two lives, a very cosy domestic life with his aged P, as he calls him, his old father, who's stone deaf but very cheerful and happy, and enjoys having a newspaper read to him even though he can't hear a word of it, and the office. And as Mr. Wemmick leaves his home and walks towards the office, his mouth, Dickens says, changes and becomes more like a slit in a post box as he changes.
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
Dickens really got this idea that we're one person at work, you know, and another person at home. I think McLean is absolutely right. The book is full of wonderful humour, Great Expectations, as are all Dickens's books. And Great Expectations is the one that has this rather ambiguous ending. You don't quite know whether Pip and Estella are going to get together finally or not, and it depends on the reader, I think, how they interpret that.
Certainly in your biography, it's anything but all grim. I mean, what a robust life. Here he is writing maybe 4 hours every morning and then walking 10, 12, 15 miles everyday dancing, horseback riding. This is an extremely vigorous man and unbelievably prolific. The amount of writing way beyond what people know from his novels, just astounding.
Yeah. That's what I was hoping to show in the biography, the fact that he was pouring out so much journalism, so many essays, short stories, plays, poems even, at the same time that he was writing these great novels, month by month or week by week writing them, and at the same time writing all these very varied essays, some very personal ones, some very highly political and satirical.
Let's go to Mark in Hartford, Connecticut, if we may. Mark, you're on the air.
Gentlemen, God rest ye.
And ye.
Three quick ones. The third one I just thought of. Unrelated. A, Dickens' conflicts with the copyright situation of his works in America. Secondly, George Orwell's essay. And thirdly, did or did he not have dinner with Edgar Allan Poe and Washington Irving? I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you so much. Very, very nice.
Thank you, Mark. Poe and Irving first. Did he dine with them in America or...?
Well, he certainly dined with Irving. I mean, Irving, and he was a huge admirer of Irving's writings. Irving's writings were very, very popular in England, and Irving was one of the people who urged him to come to America, and he said, you know, you'll have such a triumph as has never been seen in this country since Lafayette came here. Mm. So one of the first things that Dickens wanted to do when he got to New York was to meet Washington Irving, and they did dine together, and Irving made a speech in his honor, and they became very, very close friends. Poe, he met, Poe called on him in his hotel, I think it was in Philadelphia, and I don't know whether they actually dined together, but they certainly spent time together. Dickens had been very impressed by some reviews that Poe had written in the Southern Literary Messenger of his work. I think Poe had guessed the ending of the plot of Barnaby Rudge, which astounded Dickens. And Dickens promised to help Poe try to find an English publisher, and did. We have letters where he's back in England writing to Poe, saying he's tried various publishers, but without success. So I can't actually say they had dinner, but they certainly they spent time together.
Dickens fought with his own publishers often and fiercely. And what about copyright issues in the United States?
Well, that was very much a sore point, that there was no copyright agreement between Britain and America at that time or for many years later. And it was considered very, very bad manners by the Americans for Dickens to raise this when he was being honored as a great artist and so on at dinners, to start raising the money or raising the question of money. Some of the press attacked him about this, and this upset him very, very greatly. He then resolved that he wouldn't make any further speeches, public speeches in America, since he couldn't. He would just travel through the country as a private citizen, he said. Though, of course, he still was an enormous celebrity. Mm. That was a big bone of contention and remained one.
And there's George Orwell's famous writing on Dickens, talking about how Dickens believes in the human change of heart, but didn't exactly believe or pay much attention to politics or social action.
Yeah, I think Orwell, who has a wonderful essay on Dickens written, I think, in 1940, one of the greatest essays about Dickens. It's the one where he ends up about, with every writer you can sort of see their face, and with Dickens, Dickens's face is the face of a man who is generously angry on behalf of humanity, as it were, that he, Orwell said, and Orwell, remember, was writing the end of the 1930s with all the with communism, fascism and so on, all very powerful, and he says how Dickens rose above all these kind of smelly little orthodoxies that are contending for our souls at the time, and was a great champion of humanity. It is a great essay, Orwell's on Dickens.
Denise in Providence, Rhode Island. Denise, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I had to call in. I grew up in England, and I was introduced to Charles Dickens probably at the age of 9. And nobody mentioned the book A Tale of Two Cities, but I remember even as a child how very moving that story was. And the times that we're living in today, I think that book is still so relevant to today's times and the situations that's going on in the world with the war and the peace, the love and the hate. Even in this country, you know, we have the best of times and we also have the worst of times.
Class tensions and revolution there.
Yes, yes, yes. And, you know, I hadn't heard anybody mention that book, but I thought that was actually one of the greatest books that he ever wrote.
Denise, thank you very much for your call. Let me get one more right here, if I may, from Port Charlotte in Florida. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. Say, I'm an English major and have appreciated literature all my life. However, I appreciate what Dickens writes about. Since our country right here, many people have the middle class has almost been eliminated, and many people are experiencing firsthand for the first time what Dickens has written about. Mm. How does the professor think that literature, what role does literature play in helping people through these times when they're able to, you know, Dickinson so well helps us walk in someone else's shoes?
Mm, David, thank you. Michael Slater, how about it? Dickens was a kind of poet of downward mobility. No small number of Americans have felt that lately.
Can I go back to the point about the lady was making about Tale of Two Cities?
Yes,
please.
Because
I think that's a very interesting one. We have, in fact, at the Charles Dickens Museum in London, an exhibition on right now celebrating the 150th anniversary of the first publication of Tale of Two Cities, because it appeared in his magazine All the Year Round in 1859. He wrote it in weekly installments. It's far from neglected, actually. Mm. I'm surprised. Because I thought Tale of Two Cities was one of the novels that was studied much more in like Great Expectations in America than perhaps it was here, but it is a very great novel, and it is interesting that it's the subject of a wonderful two or three wonderful films. The ending of Great Expectations, Sidney Carton's Sacrifice, is extremely well known. But I think people have been very struck today, especially with all our economic distresses and the failure of the banks and this sort of thing, by Dickens's description of France just before the French Revolution, and the way everybody was, particularly in the upper classes, were sort of going on as though everything was still okay, and actually the nation was getting deeper and deeper and deeper into debt, heading really towards catastrophe. Mm. I think that the Tale of Two Cities has a great deal of resonance for us today.
Not to mention so much of Dickens' work where people are dealing with hardship they may not have known before, that downward mobility theme. Let me get a call from Anne in West Hartford, Connecticut. Anne, you're on the air.
Hello. I just wonder about Michael's comments about Dickens' treatment of his wife after he met the young actress Ellen Tiernan, I think her name was.
Yes, when Michael Slater, you write that his life what was something like a blank page. He had 10 children by his wife Catherine, and then suddenly he has a new interest,
and she's
blank, as if she had never existed to him.
That's a terrible image, isn't it? I mean, I headed that chapter writing off a marriage, because that's literally what he does. He just writes her out of his life. I think it is very difficult for anybody to defend Dickens's behavior towards poor Catherine at this time, or perhaps really at any time.
This is for a young actress, 30 years younger than himself.
I mean, he was in his early 40s, mm-hmm. and she was just coming up to 18.
Mm-hmm.
I think she was the kind of catalyst, as it were. Dickens was becoming, and had been from the time he was writing David Copperfield onwards, becoming more and more... unhappy about his life. He wrote to his friend John Forster about his feeling of an old unhappy loss or want of something, the one happiness I've never known, the one friendship and companion I've never made, and this seems to imply that he hadn't found this in his marriage.
And so a kind of brutal letting go of that first wife. What about in the UK? Is Dickens read as much as ever today? Is he seen as receding or more relevant? You've got your own piece of the Great Recession there.
He's seen probably as more relevant, I think, if you think of the apparition of the two terrible children in the Christmas Carol, ignorance and want, that Scrooge is confronted with by the ghost of Christmas Present, these ragged, starving, wolfish children, who, by the way, are marvellously presented in the Walt Disney film that you just mentioned, mm-hmm. the new Walt Disney Carol. Mm. And Scrooge is warned, isn't he, to beware of these children of ignorance and want, because of the tremendous danger and threat that they pose to society. And I think that's as relevant today as it was then.
Ignorance and want not far enough from our door, and they grew up to be trouble. Michael Slater, we thank you for your time and for the great new biography. It really is a wonderful read. Charles Dickens, it's titled, and it's all about the man and that quite amazing life. Professor Slater, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Michael Slater, joining us from London, author of the new biography, Charles Dickens. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.